As we have previously told you in this course, action and reaction are equal and opposite, and wholly automatic. If you respect others, they will respect you. If you perform acts of disservice to others, you will be treated in the same manner. It's as automatic as a natural law, which of course it is. What we have been doing is expanding your freedom potentials. My freedoms will grow with yours. But something else is also happening here. We are pushing against the centralization of power, against forces that would remove power away from you and me. Those who currently exercise this centralized power do not see it this way. They genuinely believe it's their power, and sooner or later, they will discover that this Freedom Potentials outfit is trying to retrieve that power from them. The power people, such as the political party machines and the big bankers, are going to roar like wounded bulls. What they say against us will depend upon only one consideration: what is best calculated to neutralize graduates and discourage others from joining the course. In these circumstances, truth is not on the list of criteria. It is just one of their calculations. However, as the Christian scripture says, all things work for the best with those who love God. Let's hope that they make such a storm of it that everybody in this country has heard of Freedom Potentials, and hundreds of thousands want to do the course before the dust has settled sufficiently for the opposition to see the smile on our faces. If this course is going to have the success that we expect of it, then it is inevitable that the point is going to come when it will be attacked. When that point comes, then I think that those who have graduated from the course already need to have some understanding of why it is attacked. In this way, they may be prepared, or at least up to a point, for the outrageous criticisms that it might attract. Those who have never been publicly attacked before perhaps don't quite understand how traumatic it can be, especially when it happens the first time. The first time is always the worst, and it is usually the first time that neutralizes anybody who has taken a stand. So therefore, we need to prepare graduates for that first impact, perhaps from the highest level. So that is the major objective of this segment. We need to be able to ensure that those who have done the course and have started some form of action aren't neutralized by the dramatic impact of an initial attack. Just how far you should go in defending the course, I don't know. You will have to make decisions on that a little later, but the producers are pretty well prepared to defend the course and move on and turn those freedom potentials into actualities. We encourage you to keep on at your endeavors and never to be disheartened. The ultimate in the centralization of power is global power, a form of international government. Until recently, the movement towards globalism had merely been hinted at as a kind of international political trend. The political parties for many years have paid lip service to this view. However, the centralization of power is simply not compatible with individual freedom. George Orwell's famous novel 1984 made such a prospect too terrifying to contemplate. But the political parties have lost any vision they once had and are now largely bereft of integrity, with only superficial differences between them. This is so in all English-speaking countries, and it's a testimony to the success of the Fabian movement, the banking power and others who want to do good to us and need power to prevent our so-called ill-informed protestations against it. Centralization of power is not a trend at all. It is a quite deliberate policy, the result of long-term planning, and it has long since come into the open. The inevitable result is to drive people down the scale of existence until they become nothing but worker ants in concrete jungles, where the only quality of any sort is that of the lowest common denominator. At the end of his life, the eminent American historian, Professor Carol Quigley, wrote his major work, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. He examined the extraordinary dichotomy of a 20th century charged with unprecedented potentials and soaring hopes, yet marred by repeated tragedy. Hope emerged from the recognition that the tragic wars and depressions were man-made, and that the traditional virtues of generosity, compassion, cooperation, and intelligent foresight, increased love, spirituality, charity, and self-discipline would bring answers. Tragedy often emerged from hope, sometimes from the lack of it, but more often from hopes which were impossibly exclusive of the hopes of others, especially those of the powerful, which overrode those of the relatively powerless. Authorities to whom we would once have looked to correct this have failed us. They are seen as part of the problem. Our governments have failed us so often that we generally view them, if not with contempt, then with extreme scepticism. Appeals to values such as simple honesty or common personal integrity, values such as loyalty, are often perceived, sometimes correctly, as lip service. It seems a poor reflection on the poverty of our social morale. It was not always so, and it is staggering to have to explain to today's children what the best of the past was like. There is nothing so startling as to be approached by a child who was about to leave school and to be asked, "Tell me what it was really like in the old days. Is it true that one's houses never had locks on them? And did people ever really leave their cars unlocked in Sydney?" A simple yes seems to be a million light years away. There seems to be a growing hunger for the standards and values of an age that is long past, an age during which there was such a thing as security, care, and a genuine love. The Christian command to love thy neighbor as thyself is not a sloppy form of sentimentalism. It implied a respect for your fellows. Any self-respecting person would be expected to trust his fellows. A gentleman's word was his bond, and arrangements, even complex arrangements, were concluded with a handshake, rather than a contract in triplicate with solicitors and witnesses in attendance. That was an age when legislation for common courtesy was unnecessary, and women were treated with respect and consideration, even in times of war. But our social structure, of which these virtues were merely an outward sign, has sadly largely regressed. While the outward form remains, in the form of incredible material wealth and amazing technological advances, the social spirit, the social faith that binds us together is, though not dead, at least mortally sick. In the reign of Alfred the Great, it was the king's boast that under his reign a woman could walk from one end of his kingdom to the other in complete safety. What a different age we live in now. Which woman would dare to walk the length of a large metropolitan street after dark today? Perhaps the greatest tragedy is the attitude of the church to such temptations as now lie before us as a nation. Where there was once spiritual guidance and fearless denunciation of evil, there is willful evasion of all political and economic responsibilities by those who should be in the forefront of wrestling with the principalities and powers in high places. The psyche of the pliant group and pious platitudes have left the real battlefield without a Christian banner at all, and consequently those who lust for power over all these things seem to have a monopoly of the arena. The price yet to be paid in spiritual darkness and personal depravity just can't be estimated. And yet there are signs of stirring. There are young people who care for the West, who are even prepared to make sacrifices for it if they thought it would help to turn back the tide. Why else, for example, are hundreds of young Australians and New Zealanders to be found in silence on the battlefields of Gallipoli every Anzac Day at dawn? It's not an organised thing. There are no package tours. The guns of the great battle have been cold the greatest part of a century. The Turks just shake their heads and say, what children these Australians have that they remember their fathers so. It's because they care. They have a strange, inarticulate sense of an intangible loss, largely a mystery to themselves, and because they would like to know where they come from and would search out their roots. Despite the materialism, the sapping of moral responsibility and the evasion of reality that have been hallmarks of the last half of the 20th century, these people do care. Perhaps in the future such people, the young and not so young, will provide the sparks necessary from which the flames of regeneration can be rekindled. It can be a weary, lonely business to stand for what you know to be true. It can also have an impact on family and friends who may not share the vision or the depth of character. However, the great stayers, tapped into social credence and attuned to the quiet enjoyment of the service which is often best appreciated in anonymity, they will be compensated tenfold. The communists at their height, when they still commanded some moral force, went to great pains to find that rare person who is capable of total dedication and absolute loyalty. They tested him again and again until his value to the cause, a cause destructive to freedom, was incalculable. A people who would be free must also produce a measure of single-minded determination, whilst maintaining, just as importantly, a balanced and good-humoured approach, or not only will they never be free, but neither will their dependents nor their descendants after them. Almost everybody who takes an interest in politics sooner or later hears the quote, correctly attributed to Edmund Burke, that all that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. If you don't believe in the forces of evil, then perhaps some of the examples that will be given in this segment might serve to modify your views, at least up to a point. The experiences that some people have had in attempting to do something to oppose it reinforces that evil does exist and has a force of its own. All the greatest achievements throughout history have started from a single idea, usually from a single person, and all the great movements for reform have been inspired by ideas, especially ideas put into action. However, if you have any intention of making some form of commitment to a course of action, then you need to be aware that you will be opposed and that you will make enemies. Now, I suppose traditionally we shy away from making enemies because any form of social discomfort is something to be avoided. The Church has always taught the Christian injunction that we are to love our enemies. Now, this is not some form of cop-out. Rather, it is an acknowledgement of the fact that we will have enemies. You can't love your enemies if you don't have any. A commitment to serve truth and oppose evil inevitably results in conflict. The trick is to love the enemy and hate the evil. A professor of English and one of the best essayists that Australia ever produced was a West Australian, Professor Walter Murdoch. Murdoch wrote the bulk of his material in the 1930s and was famous in Australia for his essays, particularly during the Great Depression. One essay that Murdoch produced was on having enemies, and in it he wrote the following. My worst enemy is the man who I would rather dine with than with many of my friends. We get on with one another very well, on the perfectly frank and clear understanding that he wants my blood, and that his head served up on a charger would be a sweeter sight to me than bowls of primroses. In fact, I suppose everyone must have felt this. One of the embarrassing facts about one's enemies is that many of them are such likable fellows. He went on to say, "Nothing is more repulsive than to hear well-meaning but muddle-headed people say, when a man is just dead, he had no enemies. One feels inclined to say to them, refrain from speaking evil of him until after the funeral at least. To say that a man had had no enemies is as much as to say that he has consistently shirked his duty. It is to accuse him of all sorts of cowardly compromises and mean capitulations. The planet on which we live is not a place where a man can do the right thing without making enemies. At the present stage of affairs, life has to be thought of in terms of battle. And to say that a man, in the course of his early earthly pilgrimage, has had no enemies, is to say that he has never played the man, but has always slunk from the field, deaf to the summoning drums of duty, traitor to all that lends a glory to human life. I can think of only one man in all history of whom it can be said, in an entirely honourable sense, that when he died, he left no enemies behind him. When Marshal Navets was on his deathbed, his father confessor asked him whether he had forgiven his enemies. "I have no enemies," the old soldier answered, with equal piety and simplicity. "I have killed them all." You may object that his was the reply of a pagan, or that at least it falls a little short of the Christian spirit, but are you quite sure? Critics of the Christian religion, such as Nietzsche, have made a terrible blunder when they have dwelt on its meekness and submissiveness and forgotten its unquenchable pugnacity. It sends men out upon crusades. It bids you fight to the death for the cause you believe in. Fight, it says, and give no quarter. Only beware when you are fighting, lest you defile your good cause with personal ill will. And later, in the same essay, "It is our business," says Burke, "to cultivate friendships and to incur enmities." And nobly did he practice what he preached, not neglecting either half of life's business. There is another side to the medal. The words I quoted from Burke are not all. He adds that it is our business to have both strong and both selected. You must select your enemies. You must choose them wisely, even with a certain fastidiousness. In conclusion of the essay, Murdoch said this: "Yes, it is plain, a man can have too many enemies, but that is better, 1,000 times better, than having none. It is better than to sink into the condition of the man who thinks public affairs must go their own way without his intervention, and to whom, in the end, the defeat of the English cricketers comes to be of more moment than the defeat of an evil economic system. When this happens to you, you may know that you cease to be a man. I am not quite sure what you have become." Unquote. No man in British capitalism has been better known or more highly respected than that of C. Gordon Tether. For more than 20 years, Tether's name appeared 5 times a week at the head of a regular feature article in the London Financial Times under the title Lombards. Tether is also listed in the Guinness Book of Records as the longest-running columnist in British journalism. It was Gordon Tether's daily task to watch the world business scene, scrutinise information from every quarter of the globe, and then summarise his findings for the benefit of the readers of the Financial Times. In this sense, he could be described as the eyes and the ears, and in fact the inquiring mind, of countless businessmen, all of whom carried heavy burdens of responsibility, and all anxious to be well informed about trends and happenings in the business world, especially any trend that would give them an indication of change in market directions. So Tether was highly qualified for his job as a financial journalist and enjoyed the confidence of many well-placed people in the business world. As a result, he had access to sources of information that are not available to most of us. In 1974, Britain's Prime Minister Harold Wilson paid special tribute to Tether at the height of his career as being one of Britain's most distinguished journalists. Within months of this tribute, Tether's editor was occasionally dropping his column. Within 12 months, to the disbelief of Tether's readers in the Financial Times, he was abruptly sacked with no reason given. What had happened to C. Gordon Tether? In July 1974, Tether had read his copy of a newsletter published by the Montreal Stock Exchange firm of Lafferty, Harwood and Partners. The newsletter carried a report about a meeting on April 19th in 1974 at a luxurious holiday resort in the tiny village of Megève in the French Alps, about 20 miles from the Swiss border. It was the Hotel Mont Auvoir, which happened to be owned by Baron Rothschild, and the occasion happened to be the 21st annual meeting of a group of international financiers and politicians, industrialists, journalists, and academics. They came to be known as the Bilderbergers because the first such meeting was held in 1954 in the Hotel de Bilderberg at Oosterlijk in Holland and was chaired by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. The 1974 meeting was attended by about 100 well-known international figures, including people like multi-billion dollar international bankers, such as Nelson Rockefeller and Edmund de Rothschild. From European and North American countries came chancellors of exchequers, ministers of finance, and commanders of NATO, including politicians, and highly placed bureaucrats, such as representatives from the United States State Department, chairmen of massive industrial complexes, members of the European royal families, in short, the most high-powered assemblage of influential and famous people on earth. To Tether, it was significant that they had been meeting in secret. But for what purpose were the Bilderbergers meeting? Tether's inescapable conclusion was that, whatever the purpose of those secret meetings, they must have a considerable impact on the world's financial markets. The news about the Bilderberger meetings, which had been held every year since 1954 without him even having heard a whisper about them, must have come as a great shock to Gordon Tether. For 20 years, it had been his job to piece together the best available information from everywhere and to gain some insight into market trends. Yet here was the evidence of secret meetings of the most powerful people on the globe, powerful enough to decide, for example, whether the price of gold would go up or down, and whether money would be plentiful or scarce, and so on, thereby manipulating the world's markets at will. The penetration of the secret of the Bilderbergers worked a remarkable change in C. Gordon Tether. He began to probe further beneath the surface of the banking and financial world, and the Lombard reports became more and more fascinating, though disquieting, reading. After the May 1975 Bilderberger meeting in Turkey, Tether made these comments. "It would, of course, be ridiculous to suggest that no one should ever be allowed to be engaged in private discussion at the international level about world problems. But when people of such importance as Mr. Healy, Mrs. Thatcher, and Sir Gordon Richardson, head of the Bank of England, are saying things at an international gathering that they are not prepared to divulge to the home side, the nature of that gathering takes on a special significance. And it has to be recognized that it is not everywhere accepted that the annual Bilderberg conferences are the innocent think tank exercises they purport to be." Unquote. Thereafter, interesting things started to happen to C. Gordon Tether himself. Without any explanation from his editor, his feature, Lombard, was frequently dropped. In fact, efforts were made without success to persuade him to exercise an early retirement. Then the Lombard feature was shifted from its prestigious place on the back page to one of the inside pages. His column was axed with increasing frequency. And finally, he was abruptly, though not unexpectedly, dismissed. To put it in Tether's own words, "I was finishing an article on the behind-the-scenes forces to precipitate the slide in gold then taking place when a letter was dropped on my desk informing me that I would be permanently excluded from my column from that moment on." That marked the culmination of a bitter fight against censorship of my work, in which I had been engaged since the change of editorship 3.5 years before. So Tether had been fired by the Financial Times editor, Mr. M. H. Fisher, and no explanation was ever given. Many people inquired of the Financial Times what had become of the Lombard column. No answer was ever forthcoming. C. Gordon Tether had become the victim of his own integrity. Tether had, in fact, stumbled on a semi-submerged power structure that exists only as a network of the most influential people in the world. He had discovered that behind the mystique of international affairs, there was a guiding force. He was warned to ignore it. To his credit, he didn't. But his commitment to the truth resulted in his career being terminated. Tether is by no means the only example of a person of integrity stumbling across the existence of this international power structure. In 1975, the year that Tether was dismissed, Dr. Anthony Sutton was ranked as one of the world's top authorities on modern technology. The British-born Dr. Sutton was a research fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University in California from 1968 to 1973. Before that, he was professor of economics at California State University in Los Angeles. Sutton is a man of impeccable academic background. His main task, while he was at the Hoover Institute, was to investigate Western technology in relation to the growth of the Soviet Union's military might. Sutton produced an extremely scholarly study that ran into 3 volumes, which were titled Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, 1917 to 1930, 1930 to 1945, and 1945 to 1965, respectively, and published by the Stanford University Press. Having completed his investigation, Dr. Sutton realized that he had stumbled onto what must be one of the biggest unrecorded stories of the century. His conclusion was that the Soviet Union's entire industrial and military might had been created by Western financiers and Western big business with the connivance of Western politicians. What made this news even more of a shock was the realization that at that very time, when Americans were being killed in hundreds every day in Vietnam, American companies were still shipping to the Soviet Union the technology and equipment that they needed to manufacture still more weapons and ammunition with which to kill those Americans and their Vietnamese allies. Everyone knew the Soviet Union was the main supplier of war materials to the communist Viet Cong. Towards the end of 1972, Sutton was invited to address the Republican Party's National Security Subcommittee at the party's Miami Beach Convention. This was in preparation for the forthcoming presidential election at which George McGovern would oppose Richard Nixon. Sutton was given just 15 minutes to address the Republican Party leaders. The following, in his words, is the essence of what he had to say. "The information I am going to present to you this afternoon is known to the administration. It is probably not known to the Senator for South Dakota or his advisers. I am not a politician. I am not going to tell you what you want to hear. My job is to give you facts. Whether you like or dislike what I say does not concern me. I am here because I believe that the American public should have these facts. I have spent 10 years in research on Soviet technology, what it is, what it can do, and particularly where it came from. I have published 3 books and several articles summarizing the work. I have 15 minutes to tell you about this work. In a few words, there is no such thing as Soviet technology. Almost all, perhaps 90 to 95%, came directly or indirectly from the United States and its allies. In effect, the United States and the NATO countries have built the Soviet Union and its industrial and its military capabilities. This massive construction job has taken 50 years, since the revolution in 1917. It has been carried out through trade and the supply of plant, equipment, and technical assistance. In conclusion, Sutton said, why has the war in Vietnam continued for 4 long years under this administration, with 15,000 killed under the Nixon administration? We can stop the Soviets and their friends in Hanoi anytime we want to, without using a single gun or anything more dangerous than a piece of paper or a telephone cord. We have Soviet technical dependence as an instrument of world peace, the most humane weapon that can be conceived. We have always had that option. We have never used it. Unquote. Sutton's actual charge was that thousands of young Americans had been killed in Vietnam with American technology. Well, you'd expect that that sort of news would have shaken the United States to its very foundations. But it didn't. All the major news services were present at that conference. All the major newspapers had representatives there, and yet the report just did not appear in any major media in the United States. A number of the very small independent newspapers and some much maligned so-called extremist newsletters did their best to circulate the news around the country. Great pressure was immediately brought to bear on Stanford University not to permit the publication of Sutton's material. But all that Sutton had done was to produce in great detail a mass of evidence that was already, in general terms, known at the highest levels in the American administration. One by one, Sutton found that all the establishment channels of information dissemination, whether it be press, radio, or book publication, were closed to him. He was eventually dismissed from Stanford University. Since the abridged version of his book, National Suicide, was published, he has virtually had untouchable status conferred upon him by the United States establishment. Sutton, however, carried on his research and produced a number of other books. For example, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, in which he documented how international finance groups from New York had helped to finance the Russian Revolution. He also produced Wall Street and FDR, referring to Roosevelt, and finally, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. In the latter, he shows with massive documentary proof how the Nazi war machine was assisted by US companies, such as the Rockefellers' Standard Oil. These are just 2 examples of highly placed men whose careers were absolutely destroyed because they discovered truth that most of us do not have access to and were determined to reveal it. The information revealed by men like C. Gordon Tether and Dr. Anthony Sutton demonstrate, for those who are not already aware, that the reality of contemporary history is vastly different from what appears on the surface. Why is this the case? The answer lies in the fact that centralized power defends itself. It was because these authors sought to expose an unwritten history, one which our children have not been taught, but which determines the direction of local and international events. It influences the way we live today and the course of events in the future. The careers of those who have made a commitment to the truth and exposed the reality behind the facade have often been completely destroyed. Yes, it is true that ideas have consequences. It is true that if people are not free to express their views, their beliefs, their thoughts, and the results of their research, then there is tyranny. On the other hand, when authors are not willing or prepared to express those thoughts and to share information they have uncovered, the truth is betrayed. It needs to be understood that those who graduate from this course and those who, as a result of it, intend to take some form of action of their own, will meet opposition. We fully expect that this work, and those who put the course together, will be attacked at some point, on some pretext or another. In fact, we shall almost be disappointed if it is not, because it may mean we have failed in our objective to help train citizens in political action regarding the defence of a free society. It is not always true that the antithesis of love is hate. It is sometimes harder to be ignored or to be treated with contempt as one whose concerns are irrelevant. If this course is not attacked, it may be irrelevant. To defend ourselves, we need to master the moral sanction which involves the use of the word, that is, the ability to be able to put your case, to be able to argue persuasively. Only well-informed people are truly persuasive, so the written word, which has a permanency in communication, is invaluable. We want to encourage you to become readers. There is a reading list that comes with the course. Anybody wishing to repeat this course is welcome to do so. The repeat cost is greatly reduced, so ask your supervisor about it. We provide a more advanced course for graduates who have done this course. It is done by correspondence and tutorials. At the final point, a thesis to university graduation standards will be required. Few of us will or should bother with this very advanced training. The practical approach needed for your growth and efficient activity is to learn by doing. This approach is available to all of you. Those wishing to do more advanced courses need to apply for an interview before being enrolled. The advanced course is very inexpensive, but makes extremely heavy demands on your time. Once again, anyone who is interested in that should speak to the lecturer in charge. As you will understand by now, it has been the objective of this course to contribute to a movement of intelligent, independently motivated, well-informed and well-equipped people who have dedicated themselves to individual freedom. There is no need to commit yourself to defend the free society on your own. Many other graduates will do this course, and those who have graduated who have seen the need to resist the centralization of power have kept in touch with each other. Not all graduates maintain their association with others, but there are great advantages, especially for those who are voluntarily training themselves whilst in action. We keep in touch with them. In fact, we guarantee to contact all graduates once a year, for as long as we can, to furnish them with updated material and the opportunity to make a contribution if they can. We are going to see a decentralization of power. We are going to see an extension of freedom. We are going to see changes in finance and economics, changes in politics, changes the like of which we may never have believed. If we wait for these changes to come from the leadership of politicians, from great and famous people, then we are going to wait in vain. The people who are going to do it are the unknown people, the little people, the people who have prepared through self-disciplined action and study. Alexander Solzhenitsyn summed it up when he wrote, "New generations are growing up which are steadfast in their struggle with evil, which are not willing to accept unprincipled compromises, which prefer to lose everything, salary, conditions of existence and life itself, but are not willing to sacrifice conscience, not willing to make deals with evil." He's right. No matter where you look, there is an undercurrent. an idea in gestation, a ripple that may only occasionally break to the surface. It cuts like a knife through the troubled waters of China, subsiding for years to re-emerge as a lance in the soft underbelly of moribund regime. It's a raging torrent in Hungary and Poland, crushed at times with massive forces, then submerging the victors. The debris of a ruthlessly decimated yet victorious Afghanistan has beached in Moscow the tide washing clean the national consciousnesses of other oppressed peoples. And in the West, a new sophistication. With communism morally bankrupt, the left is a shambles, and the old conservative right no longer has communism's threat to fuel its furnaces. In the new realism of lessening fear, politics increasingly assumes the aspect of the people versus the politicians, who are now increasingly transparent as representing centralized power. Only politicians can be found to oppose voters' veto. All the people want it. Yet it doesn't happen, or is slow progress. Having democratized the word and the vote, the West is just beginning to perceive the last great despotism, the power of the dollar. The idea of democratizing money is haunting the banker's capitalism. There is a faint tinge of the spring of freedom potentials budding across the West. The 21st century is yours. Can you see its blaze of color? Our final wish for every graduate is Christ's great prophecy, that you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.